This episode, I'm joined once again by Jason Horsley to discuss his book, Big Mother, The Technological Body of Evil. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Jason Horsley, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Well, thanks. Thanks. It's nice to be back. I see we have matching backdrops.
Lots of books. It's been 4 years. Lots has happened. A lot has happened that is covered in your book that we're going to be talking about. Big Mother, The Technological Body of Evil, which is published by Aeon, who were kind enough to send me a copy. So thanks very much to them. This is kind of a tough book to describe in a way, because I think it covers a lot, but centers around maybe two or three central pillars. Obviously, we're talking about technology, what technology is doing to us, but it's with a focus on an area that's currently keen to my own heart, which is disembodiment, and what it means to be disembodied as a human being. And then alongside this, we also have the Big Mother theory, and our relationship as human beings to technology. So before we get going, and also I should mention, because you mentioned it a few times throughout the book, that this may be your last book within a certain genre, or maybe your last book altogether. I mean, so we can possibly get to that. But tell us a little bit about the backstory of Big Mother.
Big Mother. Well, on that last point, I fear I have spoken too soon. I'm going to be the boy who cried wolf as far as no more mapping hell, you know, because I just can't seem to be able to stop it. So maybe I just have to accept my fate here, because I've been recently writing weekly at my Substack, and it's, if anything, it's more hellish than ever, the stuff I'm getting into. So that's it's just a kind of optimism, but a false optimism. But the reason, big reason for it is as you may or may not know, I've moved to Northern Spain and been, we have land and we have animals, and just trying to put more and more time and energy into things that will help with my embodiment. And also, obviously, closely connected to that, lead towards more autonomy from the system that I've been writing about, this hellish, you know, postmodern system. Big Mother itself, its genesis was somewhat different from my usual books, which usually start with an anomaly of some kind that gets my attention. I'm like, I've got to see what's there. And before I know it, I'm writing another book. So that was Vice of Kings and Prisoner in Infinity and 16 Maps of Hell, I think, well, all like that. Kubrickon. Kubrickon was a bit more like Big Mother, but it was actually a request from my publishers, Aeon, which is unusual for me. So I said, sure, I do have something that I never really got into shape. And so it's a bit of a, I don't know what your experience was reading it, but it's an attempt to weave together a lot of subjects and a lot of different angles of approach on this overall problem, which I would say is disembodiment, or at least that's one way to sum it up. I did have a subtitle, The Disembodiment Agenda, because one of the things that I've been looking at over the years or decades with my writing was not so much the unified conspiracy theory in the usual sense of who's behind it, which I never found a particularly interesting question, although I am kind of looking at it now, but what's the goal, you know, or what's the method and what's the objective? And the closest I got was disembodiment. That seemed to be the most consistent theme. It doesn't even have to be a conspiratorial angle, even just in terms of modernity and the methodologies, the ideologies, and the consequences. They all seem to have this common factor of disembodiment. So obviously that relates to technology very directly, literally. And then of course the Big Mother thesis is this other thing that I had been circling around for decades, certainly since I met my wife in 2008. I became aware of myself being hostage to my own mother, who was alive at the time, an energetic hostage to the mother. I'm coining a new phrase, live. That was very much, I had a sense of meeting the woman who had become my wife. She was aware that I wasn't fully available to her psychically, psychologically, and energetically. She was aware intuitively, I think. And so she was wanting me to become more aware of it. And pretty quickly I just, oh, okay, something's going on there. Secret agreement, I think, was the phrase my wife used, with my mother. So yeah, but that was 15 years ago. It took me to get to Big Mother to really incorporate this into this larger kind of global agenda analysis.
What is it to be embodied to begin with?
Yeah, it's a good question. I remember I got in a disagreement with somebody on Facebook, which I never used, but it was a few years ago. He's saying, well, of course I'm embodied. What do you mean? He's somebody who smokes a lot of pot. So that was probably why it came up, because I said, well, pot is is an agent of disembodiment among many. And I guess he took it very literally, like, of course I'm in my body, where else would I be? But of course we can put our attention on our body and say, well, yeah, I'm here, I'm in here, which is kind of a weird way of thinking about it. But really, is our attention on our body? Is it in our body? Can we tell what's going on with our liver, with our heart, with our kidneys, even with our toes? You know, how often do we put our attention on our toes if they're cold, etc.? I mean, I could go on for a long time with this stuff. And so it seems to me it seems to me quite general that I only have really noticed what's going on with my body, which I could even extend to, I've only really noticed having a body when problems started to arise. I'm actually aware right now my shoulder's a bit naff recently. I'm not sure why. So it's making me more aware, okay, I'm not doing enough with my body to bring my awareness into my body. So that's the short answer, is how much is our awareness in the body? Right. And how much is it not in the body because it never got there in the first place?
Well, you know, already I begin thinking about this notion of, like, it will sound paradoxical, but you mentioned agenda at the beginning, but it's like an agenda without an agenda, right? An agenda, it's happening, but there isn't any centralized possible reason why people would cultivate this. But this notion of not being in your body, of being disembodied, you know, right now you mentioning those things, you realize that, I might as well not have, I don't know, feet right now, right? They're not, I have absolutely pretty much, I do now because I've mentioned it. And of course, I'm now suddenly aware of my feet. But until then, the question as to where one was seems to be this, a matter of, like, modernity's pragmatic and practical attitude towards everything should just be perhaps a function of work or a function of quantification. Because, you know, this is a discussion I've had with so many people. Many people would argue, well, of what use is it to, you know, I think of time, a long time sort of studying someone like Gurdjieff or many other spiritual writers who would have a focus on the body. And many people's sort of criticism of that is, like, what is the use of constantly, like, focusing on your body if there is no real, like, product, quote unquote, productive use of it, right? And then that, of course, brings forth the question, well, where exactly are we? Like, what is the purpose of being? And I think the sort of horrifying, quote unquote, agenda again is that, you know, we drive or walk to and from work, but we're completely asleep during that commute. Like, you have no bodily or autonomous reception that even happened. Many people will say that they felt like they were transported. And then what are the moments where we're actually conscious? You know, I can't think of many throughout the day where I actually am conscious. So there's this, I think it really ties in with what it is to be and what the actual meaning of being is completely entwined with embodiment. Because when you're not embodied, your existence just passes you by and you can, you know, how many minutes of the day can you actually recollect? And usually it's when you had a bodily response. So that's one thing. And the other thing I'll throw in is that what you're saying about noticing your body when things go wrong is there's like a tangent to our history of medical writers who've written on this idea, starting with Galen, who says, you know, the purpose of the body is to be in harmony. And it's when it's disharmonious, when it's making noise, which I guess with your shoulder is like an internal noise, that's when you notice it. So we never really notice the harmony. We never notice when things are right, right? You never notice how great your nose is when it's unblocked. But when it's blocked, oh man, it's the worst thing in the world. So I think embodiment, meaning, we just disappear without the body, I think. I'm going to throw in one more thing because I have to criticize myself. Because I'm speaking in a way that I don't like, which is saying the body, as if separation, there's this whole other thing. And I think that was our great error, or one of the great errors is mind-body split is just terrible for us.
Yeah. I had a lot of thoughts we were talking, that's why I'm hesitating now, but I just have to start with the one I hold on to, which is this, you know, who are we if not the body? And this is non-rhetorical, but starting with maybe kind of more rhetorical, as in we are the body. I mean, as far as we know, I think the idea of the soul is a necessary placekeeper to move towards. So hopefully we'll get to that. But to start with, the idea, we can talk about the mind, but you can't locate it and you can't define it. You can't say what it's made of except thoughts, but then that's chicken or an egg, circular, etc. Whereas the body, there's no problem. It is a problem because we've been so alienated from it and even awareness of it. And most of us don't even know, you know, basic biological fact. But you can start anytime, like 1, 2, 3, 4, like for 10 fingers, it's quantifiable. And you can do all these experiments with it. Of course, you know, you can do meditation stuff with the mind, but it's still, you know, my point is that the mind and the self, this idea of a self, as philosophers have been struggling with for millennia, is very amorphous. You can't really locate it. Is there even such a thing as a self? So my point of view for years really has been not I am my body, but the only thing I can be sure of that signifies that I have existence as an individual entity is the body. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know where my mind comes from. I don't know where my thoughts come from. I can't be sure my memories are accurate. And anyway, memories don't make up an identity. They just make up a series of et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. So whereas the body is provably discrete, you know, it exists somewhat separately. You can get into, you know, various ways in which it's not separate, and I think you need to. But anyway, I just end on that point that, you know, let's just start with who am I? Okay, I'm the body. So then what is the body? This is reminding me of other thoughts I had, which is, if I can formulate them, maybe I can't actually, but it was, I think you were circling around, you know, what's the agenda? What would the agenda be to keep our awareness out of the body, and how that relates to the creation of an alternate way of experiencing ourselves as existing, which is mental, which keeps us out of the body. That I just, you know, as a sort of summation of the disembodiment agenda, it is, I think, to keep our awareness out of the body so that we're crippled and lacking autonomy and real, you know, kind of ability to act consciously, and also to keep the body vacant for something else to come in.
Mm. Well, there's a couple of things I'd throw in here immediately. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the philosophy of Ludwig Klages. I mean, he's not very well known at all.
But, not at all.
In short, in very, very short, he would say that at one point in time, he would probably call it primordial ancient time. The body and the soul were one, and we just experienced. And then at a certain point in time, historical time, very, you know, sort of Western, I guess, Western modern historical time, where we began to quantify what he would say is in German, as he was German, Geist, the spirit, came down and split the body and soul into two parts, which ever since we've sort of been this fractured human being. And really the question that's haunted me ever since coming across this philosophy is, for him, the spirit has very clear meanings, multiple meanings. But I think this question of what is the thing that has at some point entered the discussion and split that original dynamic, which I do find myself in agreement with, whatever the soul means, I think is originally, very risky word, but like originally one-on-one, and something has come in and split. And I think how that thing is aggrandizing and building itself, and why we, what relationship we have with it, is probably one of the most important questions. And the other thing that I would add in there, in the sense of knowing you're an individual in terms of the body, is actually something temporal. And I think this has a relationship, deep relationship with technology, is that the body is the only part of us that is actually present. It's very, very difficult to get the mind, whatever that is, to be present, to be right now. I think about most of my thoughts, even if I'm trying to, I don't know, describe, like if someone said, ask me the question, what is the color on the front of your book cover? I'm in a way, my mind still has to go back to the past to recall the color yellow, and like there's a whole recall. So you're either worrying about the future, or you're also worrying about the past, or going over the past. So the body is this thing that absolutely roots you, and it seems, you know, and I got this impression from, you know, to get this, to gravitate this more towards your book, that technology does this thing of just making us completely rootless in time as well. We just have no roots. And yeah, it's a strange phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Again, I keep going, this chicken or an egg question keeps coming to me in one context or another, because is technology, is it a cause or is it an effect? Is it a symptom of disembodiment, or is it the thing? And clearly it's both. So it does raise the question, you know, how and why did we end up developing forms of technology, because crows use technology. I mean, crows use tools here and, you know, now and then, what have you. There are other animals that are intelligent enough and cognizant enough to know how to work with their environment in a way that we could say is artificial. We probably wouldn't say it was artificial because they're animals, which is, actually reminds me, I was thinking about what you're talking about with the soul and the body split, that probably, if that's true of human beings, I don't know, that would be a closer to an animal condition, where it would seem as though animals, their body, soul, it's a continuum with nothing, you know, separating, right? I would say for animals, the soul and the body. Whereas for humans, yeah, something came between. It's curious that he says the spirit, because to me, the spirit's, you know, the good guy. I might say a spirit, I'll say, you know, some sort of entity split us, and somehow that's related to our developing technology in a way that isn't just natural, making the most of our environment to solve problems, but is somehow dissociative. And, you know, when did it begin? Who knows? But fire, as I write in the book, is a form of technology. Language is a form of technology. And these are things that help us to have a more functional relationship to our environment, but they then can become very quickly things that disassociate ourselves from our environment and therefore from our bodies. Because my experience, and I presume yours and everybody else's, if they take the time to, you know, get away from their computers and stuff, is that the more I am interacting with nature, slash matter, because if you're building a table, say, that's not directly nature as we think of it, but we see interacting with matter, the more present I am in my body, the more my attention is on my body, even if it's not in the way that we said, Gurdjieff, you know, like put your Strieber, he had this thing where he puts his attention on his body every day. I don't know what good it's done with his Strieber, but anyway, that's a meditation thing. What I'm talking about isn't that I'm consciously more in my body. Mm-hmm. I might be, you know, cursing and railing against the hammer or the nail or the goats or whatever it is. So in many ways, I'm still, you know, in my deranged ego, but I can't help but be more in my body because I'm just constantly using it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think with regards to technology? Because I find a lot of the philosophy around technology lacking, and I imagine you do as well with regards to your statement about the crows, right? This constant discussion about, you know, let me backtrack there. It almost seems redundant to me to, philosophers would always bring in this thing of saying, well, a hammer is technology. And I always think, well, that's not really what we're talking about. But that, in my own criticizing myself there, it's not as if I can suddenly describe exactly what I mean. The closest I've come is in saying that I think technology becomes this disembodied problem when it becomes meta-technological. So when the technology begins to have a relationship with itself, as to say, like, how can a hammer be a better hammer, right? And this is what all our technology now does, is it has not necessarily AI, but we have a self-knowledge of it as technology. And in that sense, we're trying to make it a better technology. Whereas I think you go back to a certain point in time, once again, I'm not really harking back to a primitivism here, but you go back to a certain point in time, the technology isn't the end, it's a means to an embodied process. So the hammer is just building the hut. There isn't this relationship of like, how can we build a more efficient hut? How could this hammer be more hammery? And I think that's where we've gone wrong, is we suddenly just enter into the abstraction of technology. And dare I say it, technology isn't even embodied anymore. I mean, in a way, a computer screen almost reflects what it is to be a human being. Like the digital code is the thoughts, but we can't really say what they are. And it's so far away from what it really is, which is basically just rocks that can think. You end up in a very horrible place. And I've mentally now put myself in a very horrible place.
Well, yeah, we pretty much have to agree to admit that we are in a horrible place collectively, not necessarily individually. I don't feel I'm in a horrible place personally, but I look out and I see that collectively we are in a horrible place. Hence these conversations and these books and all the rest of it. And hence this question, you know, what is technology and how and why did it go wrong? I was thinking about the hammer, that it's not just the hammer that wants to be a better hammer. It's also the human who wants to have a permanent hammer attached to his hand and just to go around using it the whole time because the hammer makes him feel powerful. So that, you know, the cliche that to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. There's something about how when we use technology or create technology and use it in such a way that it empowers us as a compensatory thing. We might actually end up with a big mother thesis here if we keep on this track. But, you know, the impoverished or the crippled male identity that needs to feel powerful might invest a little bit too much in having a big hammer, right? And so then the way the hammer's being used, and that's probably where it starts with, if technology becomes somehow malevolent and it's kind of self-organizing or self-improving, as you're saying, it presumably starts with the people who created it. And I think it would relate to this. So that was one thought. The other one I had was that what's the difference between creating technologies that is an extension of the body that improves the body's functionality in nature, as you're talking about, with hammers and fire and stuff, and one that extends the mind, reaches the mind? Because that seems to be a big difference between computers.
Mm.
I mean, it goes way further back, of course, but what we can see now is a great deal of our technology has to do with computers, and a great deal of this, well, clearly, because it's disembodying people, it is to do with empowering the mind. So what is that? It seems to be more and more of a dissociation into fantasy and a way to fulfill fantasies that don't actually extend the efficacy, the functionality, much less the autonomy of the body in nature. They rather allow us to dissociate more and more into a non-physical fantasy that we like to call reality.
So I think one of the things you mentioned there just made me think of another German philosopher, actually, Günther Anders, who was a philosopher of technology, and he talks about his experience of going to back when you used to have, well, I guess you still have them, but you don't hear about them as much, technological fair where there would be all the new things. You walk around and see all the new gizmos that are going to further disembody us. And there's some of the first dishwashers were there. And one of the things he noticed was that when people were stood in front of them looking at them, they put their hands behind their back. And he theorized that it wasn't anything really grand. It was impotence and embarrassment because they looking at a thing that, oh, wow, this can do everything way better than me. And I sort of, in a way, I pushed back against this theory because it seemed quite silly, but I wonder if at root there is this admittance of the human being in a very strange position. You know, I mean, this almost becomes kind of biblical in the way of the human being isn't an animal. You know, we've spoken about crows, but if a crow used it all, we'd say they're just completely, a crow does what a crow does. It's kind of tautological. But then something completely above that, which we would say is pure spirit, like an angel, has got its own thing. And human beings are always caught in this strange in between where we're not fully primitive, but we're not fully technological. And so it seems like we always are part of technology and we're always embarrassed about that fact. You know, I mean, I guess actually that quite literally is biblical, because what's the first thing when we do is we cover ourselves before God. The fig leaf is the first technology of complete embarrassment of our nature. And once again, I'm not harking back to primitivism because I think that's just such a silly position. But it's this problem of having a relationship with technology, which is, you know, where we're not embarrassed. And I think this does connect to your big mother theory, because a close friend of mine always says that really the end game of technology just seems to be everyone wants to crawl back into the womb. And it's just complete coddling, complete giving up. Throwing lots at you there again.
Sure. That is exactly the Big Mother thesis, so it's good. I assume that he made that comment without reading Big Mother. So it's good if others have reached that recognition. There seems to be something in there about being seen, as seen and not seen, but referred to before we started. And in Big Mother, I write about the way that our identity is formed under the mother's gaze, and how that, if that doesn't happen fully organically in a healthy way, then we're essentially crippled from there on in. Feeling like terrified of the mother's gaze in one form or another, but at the same time desperate to get it, and just really trying to pull my own thoughts together now. When you're saying about the shame with technology, where my mind went was the global village, social media, social networking, and of course now social credit, which I'm sure somebody like you or I or all of your listeners see as something that, let's say, that's not benign. Like it's an idea that's disguised as something benign, but basically is oppressive, controlling. That all of these things do relate to and or intensify this feeling of shame, embarrassment, inadequacy, I think was the thing you're describing with the washing machine. Because I'm sure I'm not alone in finding that using social media on the internet is a constant constantly onerous sort of checking what's my value, how many likes, how many retweets, what about, how come that guy's getting, even with you, it's like, you've been doing this about 4 years, we'll bring it really into the room now. Oh no, not 4 years. We haven't, you've spoken to me 4 years ago, but before that, you've been, how long have you been doing this?
Six years.
6 years, right. Right. And you, I don't know, we've got 15,000 followers on Twitter or something like that. So you got like seven times me. I'm just making it really personal now so we can bring it into the room. And I've been doing this shit for 30 years. So things like that, they're like, what the fuck? You know, so that, I think we all have that experience to wonder, you know, and the more insecure our ego is, the more we're going to have it. But there's something about, this is René Guénon's reign of quantity, there's something about the landscape of the electronic media village that constantly accentuates the feeling of inadequacy, which is shame. I'm not good enough. I'm not as good as this guy or this machine or this pro, right? It's somehow, it's baked in. So I think, yeah, the original sin, it does pertain to some sort of shame of you're not good enough. Even Lucifer, the fall of Lucifer, gone from the room now to the whole cosmos, that it was seemingly Lucifer was envious. God was saying, look, they're so great. And Lucifer's, well, what about me? I was great yesterday, right? And so he gets pissed off. And so I think it's really, it's close to the core of something.
Definitely.
Comparison, right? Yeah, comparison leads to shame.
So I think this notion of social credit, which is, it's strange, right? Because I think the point at which we are almost grotesquely disgusted by it is the point in which something that is disembodied is becoming embodied. Because something like social credit ideologically has always existed, right? If you're a weird, you know, and I'm a self-admitted weird person, if you're a weird person, job interviews don't go as well for you. You know, you're not playing the social game. There is this underlying, what we might, maybe some people disagree with my naming of this, but there is this underlying system of this person likes X, Y, and Z. Therefore, we put them in the normal bracket. They're not going to be a dissident type problem. In the evolutionary sense, there's a complete understanding of why this is the case because, you know, it's a risk to not fit in. So I think that notion of social credit has always been there. Mm. But it's strange because that's completely disembodied. It's a very intuitive social understanding. But in this point where it's now becoming embodied in technology because social media, even though it's completely unreal, is, you know, I can see, you know, you've quantified how many times I'm normal in likes, you know, because they're just agreements, right? And it's almost... How much do people agree with you? How competent are you? You know, I guess in the sense of the hammer, like it's sort of a marker of like, social credit potency, right? We don't really get away from ourselves very much, but it's certainly something there. But I think all technology is moving towards that, right? Of this notion of something inbuilt in technology is always about comparison. I think it goes back to that meta level, right? Of a technology always knows itself. And that's where you start having problems.
Yeah, and I think the connecting theme, or at least what I'm going to zero in on, is identity. I mean, remember that Marshall McLuhan sentence, quote, all forms of violence are quests for identity, roughly that. All forms of violence are quests for identity, which is bringing to mind René Girard and his sort of model, which is different, but I think it intersects with McLuhan. And of course, we've got intersectionality and identity politics, which is very obviously a violent quest for identity. And so what is it about, why did I bring this up in the context of this mass media and what we're talking about now, technology? There's a kind of, like, so much of what we do as compared to a hammer that's just, you know, you use it just when you need to hammer the nail in and build something. So much of what we do is like constant 24/7 trying to reinforce and reify our sense of existing as an identity and the value. And that's through value. Basically, the more social credit you have, not necessarily from Klaus Schwab and the gang, but from your own fan base, because they've given us this little playground for now where we feel we can create our own echo chambers and or communities, bit of both, and so have a sense of value and meaning that I'd say is somewhat genuine. As in, you get the likes, it's not just anybody, people agreeing with you, it's people getting something from what you're doing and giving something back. And so potentially you are building a mini consensus, which, you know, there is some, that can be very grounding for people to have a sense of, yeah, okay, I'm not crazy, right? I'm not crazy because, but that can definitely be turned against us. And that if there's too much of an element of the echo chamber, which is just, I'm afraid of going crazy without enough validations, if you see what I mean. Not just, I might be crazy because I'm saying things that other people aren't saying, but I might be crazy because I don't really know who I am or if I even exist if I don't have somebody affirming it, because that matter is, that's an unstable ego, it's a weak ego. And you can't grow spiritually if you don't have a strong ego. That's a very basic model there, even though it seems paradoxical. So anyway, I just wanted to zero on this identity, because there's something about identity which is close to the core of disembodiment, as we've touched on already, and there's some force in the universe that is trying to itself, you said it about technology, it's trying to say I exist when it doesn't in that way. Like, it's a kind of, what is that? It's a pathology.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that the social media aspect moves from agreement, you know, how many people agree with me, really what might actually be at the root of that is just to exist. I mean, it made me think of Winnicott. I'm bringing out a load of obscure names
today. I know Winnicott, at least.
Winnicott in Playing in Reality. He had that theory to try to devise a theory of why infants that yet to verbalize or be able to really, you know, mark themselves as really existing. He looked at that game Peekaboo, you know, like you cover your eyes or cover their eyes and then say Peekaboo. And his theory was that it was because in that act was the acknowledgement that it's like, oh, I exist. Thank you for like telling me I exist. I have no way other than screaming at you or whatever to really tell you I exist. And the whole social media just seems like a massive game of peekaboo. I mean, it's probably an extremely pessimistic thing to say, but at root of all of this is it possibly constant? You exist more if you have more likes, more followers, you know, if you're more disembodied into that technological reality, you you somehow exist, but your existence is your existence is based off being seen, ironically it isn't based off being seen, though, because we both know that that's not the truth. The existence is based off your own appreciation, your own fantasy of how many people you understand to be seeing you. Because my 15,000 followers, 15,000, by the way, you know, they're not all constantly checking my Twitter or whatever it might be. So it's,
What did I say? Did I say 1,500?
No, it's a joke. I was just joking.
I was rubbing
my hammer.
sure. Yeah. It's theory of mind. Like, we don't know that they even exist most of the time. And the comment, we could get 10 comments from 10 different people, it could be the same person using sock puppets and so on and so forth. As I say, this is why I've really tried to meet the people that follow me or read me. And obviously I can't meet all of them, even if they all agreed, I wouldn't have time, but they don't, is the thing. It's like one in, I don't know what the numbers are, 1 in 100 or 1 in 200 actually emails me. But I like to, you know, put a name and if possible a face. And this is very much to my larger attitude or position about figures, cultural figures who are influential. I think there's something dodgy about this because they can't, it's a parasocial relationship. It's a one-way relationship. And so there seems to be something fundamentally unhealthy about that. And so that's what we're talking about here. Like, if you're being validated, I don't think you could say there's something wrong with being validated in itself, because communities, of course, it is all about interaction, and you want to check. You know, I'm working on this barn, and you know, I'm not sure if the beam here is strong enough. Can you validate it? Can you, right? Which reality checking is really essential.
That has an explicit purpose.
That's right.
The validation we're talking about is validation of validation. Yeah, but validation of validation.
Well, sure, it's the mission creep, the slippery slope, but it is a spectrum, like the civil technology, because, you know, I'm writing, as you may or may not know, currently I'm writing about World War II, the Holocaust, really dangerous, literally dangerous topics, but also, because you can go to jail for them, but also very sensitive. In various different ways. So I want to be very careful. It's a minefield. Not only can I blow my own foot off, but I might blow somebody else's foot off, you know, with collateral damage. So it's very good then to get feedback. Like, yeah, we're following along. Okay. Whatever it is, it's really good to get feedback. So that's more like checking the beam. Is it solid? Well, so it would be pretty hard to. But as with technology, where do you draw the line exactly? And you're admitting you can't, between the hammer and the fire and the good technology and, you know, transgender surgeries and mRNA vaccines, bad technology. It's somewhere closer to the hammer end of the spectrum. I think we know that, but we still don't know quite where it lies. So similar with this.
Well, one place I want to head towards, because you draw on his work so much, Philip K. Dick, this blending of fact and fiction. And it's interesting that, you know, the culture of celebrities seems to have has just gone sort of absolutely insane. I mean, it's almost on par with like old days of old king worship. You know, you'd see the divine right king who you believed had an actual connection with God and would be absolutely, like, quite literally hysterical, you know. And I think about what we've been talking about, this sense of validation, and to exist is to have more and more, to exist more is to have more likes. And I think about someone like, I'm sure you're aware of his work, his oeuvre, Mr. Beast, you know, probably the most famous person on YouTube now. But if you see clips of people,
Mr. Beast,
it's his name.
Oh, well, I'm not aware.
You're not aware of him.
He passed me by.
Well, yeah. Okay, we can take any big name celebrity, but there's this strange thing, I guess, to see when someone sees a celebrity, ironically, embodied. You know, someone goes to a concert and they hear the song that they've been hearing in a disembodied sense, real. When they're there on the stage, there's a sort of hysteria around that. And it's, you know, the hysteria seems to be around, like, the fiction, the complete fiction that they've made up has become fact. And in that sense, our reality has now become far more fiction. And recently I had that review of Valis, which I sort of then said is almost the say holy text of our day, in the sense that it really deals with what to do with when you acknowledge the complete merging and blending of fact and fiction. And that seems to be the other angle that we haven't touched upon in terms of this disembodiment, is that it draws us into a realm where fact and fiction are blended in an extremely, extremely dangerous way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's, as you know, the subject of Prisoner Infinity, probably more than, but certainly as much as Big Mother. This is a question that, to me, it veers into the, not just the unknowable, but because of its unknowable, like, it's very hard to talk about it, because we know that there's a whole, to me anyway, the what the bleep do we know quantum mechanics mixed with new age thing, that you create your own reality. There's something very pernicious about that I just want to say, no, we don't, right? Observe the law of matter. You know, you can't use magical thinking to unbend the nail. You're going to have to, if you did it wrong, you're going to just have to use matter against matter. And, you know, for thousands of years, farmers, peasants, ordinary people had no time for this kind of theory, right? Mm. But on the other hand, sorcerers have existed throughout time. You go as far back as you want. You will have shamans, I think, mm. of some form or another. And they do practice weird stuff like this. It's unclear like how effective they are, because a big part, as I covered in 60 Mats of Hell, a big part of it, as in stage magic today, is about sleight of hand and trick of eye. So you think they've done a miracle, but they haven't. Mm. And also managing perception, this is where we really get into a fuzzy area. If you manage perception, obviously you change people's experience of reality, but maybe you can change reality. This whole question of how objective is reality is a question. Physical reality, like we know that psychic reality, I think, isn't very objective. Like you can end up believing things that are completely unreal, and nobody can bring you back from there, and then that becomes your reality, in quotes. It doesn't become reality for other people unless you implement, you know, a very forceful kind of ideology which says, yes, you must affirm my pronouns, etc. But even, you know, that's a kind of giveaway that they have to, in that example, they have to criminalize misuse of pronouns or dead naming, etc., around transgender, because just the assertion this is reality isn't enough. You have to actually put these laws in place to make people go against what they know is true. So clearly objective reality is really a necessary thing we need to hold on, like literally to a life raft, to the idea, to the recognition that objective reality exists. But to me, it has to include the proviso in, I'm getting very abstract now, so hopefully I can bring it back to concrete, but it has to be the admission that you can, by definition, you cannot know objective reality, because it wouldn't be objective. You know? So it's this weird paradox. You've got to say, yes, it exists, and I will do everything I can to align with it, observe the law of matter, but I can't be foolish or hubristic and say, I know what objective reality is. I think you can say, I know what it's not, because I think we've seen it more and more in our culture. You have to say no to these fantasies that are being imposed upon us. Anyway, so I bring it back to what you led with, which was the blending fact and fiction. I'll bring it all the way back to Philip K. Dick. He's doing that as an author, and that's his job, in a healthy way, or a respectable way, I think, is to write novels and make interesting stories and transmit compelling ideas and thoughts, mm. fiction, and make the fiction more real by imbuing it with reality, including, in his case, actually literary autobiographical reality. And I think Philip K. Dick is interesting as a case study, as Whitley Strieber was, because he does show how slippery that slope is. So I saw you weren't sure when I was saying I think it's a good thing telling fiction stories, and actually I agree. I'm not sure if it is a good thing. It might be symptomatic of something. You know, why do we need them in the first place?
I think fiction stories can be fine. It's the blending. It's the blending which seeks to not really make explicit, which is worried. I mean, yeah. which is worrying. I mean, Philip K. Dick does that a lot. I don't. You say that's his job. It never. When I read Philip K. Dick, or at least if you read, when I've read his biography and then sort of looked at his works, it doesn't really come across to me as that was his job.
So well, I meant it's his exercise. I meant. Oh sure, yeah, good point. But I just meant it's his job to tell stories and make them believable. So of course you've got to import some reality in there. Mm. The thing of blending actual autobiographical detail with fiction, it's an interesting question, because I've never been able to do it. Like, I've tried to write fiction, including trying to turn my life into fiction, and I could never do it. It was like I had some psychological resistance to it. Mm. And so I wonder if that's a healthy thing. And if it's, yeah, it's basically, if it's a bad idea. I think Philip K. Dick, I think he did end up kind of obsessively trying to get back to reality, mm. or he might have said trying to get forward to the reality that he'd never, but either way, He was kind of lost in his own fictions in the end, to some degree. As I write about Whitley Strieber, seems to be to this day, has generated such a powerful matrix of belief that he rules over, so to speak, you know, as in he's the one who made it, and other people, it's a cult, other people believe in it. So that he becomes a prisoner of it. And I think that we see that in society. We certainly see it in cults, that the people who create cults, unless they're just CIA agents and they're just pretending, and of course that happens too, but insofar as they really believe the role that they're playing, they become imprisoned by it. And then I think we could say we see it, on a large scale, that we're all part of this cult of make-believe, essentially. We are living, became sort of observable with the COVID years, was this LARPing, the live action role playing that people were engaged in.
We crave that, though, because one thing that was probably just an extremely pessimistic moment for me was seeing people, you know, have this sort of break chasm in that live action role playing, as you say it. And notice, you know, I saw a lot of people, ironically, online, because they're all shut in, suddenly going, you know, I'm not sure I'm really living my life. I'm not really, you know, I'm not happy or fulfilled, or, you know, this is all unreal. But then as soon as the sort of the floodgates were open for everything to return to normal, people craved it even more, you know, very much like a hyper big mother, like running to the womb when, you know, it had been barred for them for a little bit of time, and then they ran back. And it was a very pessimistic moment to see that. I'm not sure what could be done to halt it, but that's at least what I saw. I don't know if your experience was the same. But I'm not going to judge anyone for that, the comfort that comes from that belonging, which probably ties us in with autism, right? Of really autism, your own autism, but autism in general plays a big role in the book. And I think it's, you know, I mean, you mentioned about how autism makes people experience time differently, memory differently, and really at base is it's like an artificial natural existence, which isn't natural. You see what I mean? So for people who are natural, it's like the non-natural way that you can't help being. There's no decision in it, but it is a. It's very Dickian, right? Because it's you begin to question whether or not what your reality, the reality you are seeing, is. You know, when you maybe it's a hyperfixation, and people say, "Well, no, it's not as important as you think." And you think, like, I'm never not going to be able to not hyperfixate on whatever it is I'm fixating on. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first obvious thing is, you know, what's a health? If you're living in a dysfunctional society, you know, how can you take the diagnosis of what being functional is? That's the obvious starting point. But that's a kind of trope, you know, R.D. Lang and these other characters that were trying to argue that schizophrenia is closer to insanity. And I think that itself was also a bit weaponized, let's say, oversimplified. But it is important, and it is to keep that in mind. And it is difficult, the term autism, how many people listening to this when it airs, and how many people out there in general associate autism now with mercury poisoning, vaccinations, that, you know, brain damage. It's been fairly effectively rebranded. I mean, when I was first writing the material that ended up with Big Mother, and when I wrote Seen and Not Seen, there was much more, I think, there was more of a neurodiversity movement awareness. I'm not sure what's happened to it, I'm sure it's still out there, but I do think that transgender is one example of how that, a genuine neurodiversity awareness thing, I don't want to say movement, but it doesn't have to be a movement, but just, you know, a kind of mini zeitgeist, was rechanneled into channels that were corporate controlled, you know, they could be monetized and weaponized and so on. So I imagine that many people who were thinking, "No, I'm neurodiverse," which is a very neutral term, basically, it's just as compared to neurotypical, neurodiverse, may now identify as another sex or a different, or an animal, or you know, a telephone or whatever else it is that, that is being sanctioned now. So there's that just to consider as far as just, you know, defining the word or redefining the word. I used to say autism is a one word oxymoron because it means one who doesn't really fit and can't be labeled. Mm. That's how it meant to me. Somebody who doesn't fit with the herd and is kind of unique. Autos is his very own self. You know, autos is the self. So I think initially it was more a reference to self-immersion, that autistic children tended to be self-immersed and kind of just in their own world, which is how Dick writes about it. But I thought, well, you could also extend that, the definition of autos, to somebody who is self-defined. So I mean, that's become something very dodgy now, again, with identity politics. But so maybe self-defined isn't quite the word, but who refers to their own inner experience to know what's what, which to me, that is autonomy, that is integrity. We talked about a number of different ways in which it's a problem if your attention's too much outside you in order to get things to support your sense of meaning and truth and so on. So I just kind of maybe start with that if we're going to talk about autism. These two things, it is self-immersive, so it tends to be interior focused, which can mean it doesn't connect very well to the environment. But it's also, there's a reason for it. It's just like, who am I? I've got to look inward. You know, look inward to find out who you are.
I'm not sure where to go from there.
Well, no hurry.
Sorry?
No hurry. I mean, we tend to feel that there's pressure. I know I do. Oh, don't leave big gaps and things like that.
Well, sooner than the gap. Yeah, no. We're both playing the general game, right?
Yeah,
there's pressure, even though if you look at there it pragmatically, there absolutely
there isn't.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's identity again. You got this
identity. One thing on identity, you know, reading recently, finishing Peter Kingsley's Catafalque, where he spent a lot of time with the notion from Jung of Luciferian individualism. So this difference between individuation and individualism. So
does that come from Jung? Luciferian individualism.
So Kingsley would say that the individual and Peter Kingsley understands that the, and I think this is from Jung's terminology somewhere in his, you know, gigantic corpus. So probably wouldn't be too tough to find, but the general notion that the individual, like the modern, I choose what I buy, you know, I have this many likes, once again, that is, for Jung, it's a Luciferian trait. And it's interesting, you know, thinking about that in terms of, you know, I see Satan fall like lightning, and the first rebellion is that in that sense, that terminology is, the Luciferian individualism is, you know, at its root, that form of being an individual, that form of being an identity is a rebellion against something that we can't, you know, something that we can't name. That's the big problem. But it's, you know, once again, that sort of, to go back to the dishwasher example, that sort of embarrassment, that impotence, a rebellion against this constant having to admit to the fact that you are, I don't know, I guess fleshy and embodied and clumsy and aching and whatever it might be. And probably some other more abstract things that I can't put my finger on, which maybe comes closer to, maybe an embarrassment, oh, I have a soul and I have to deal with that. Or, you know, oh, I am part of God's creation or whatever it might be. But there's a certain embarrassment in front of that. And technology keeps you overstimulated, you know. I was trying to think of, I had my notes, and just with the autism and this notion of stimulation, it seems that identity is something that it's like, keep stimulating. You know, I exist. Sure. When it stops, you know, which it rarely does,
yeah,
it's like, What do I do? There's a panic. Embarrassment of existence.
Well, there's a thing called annihilation anxiety. I don't know where that comes from, because I got it from my wife, so I don't know if it comes from an actual, you know, source or if it's a phrase that she coined, but it pertains to what we've been talking about with the mother, but also what you were talking about being seen, that as our identity is forming, the peekaboo example, like the thing I've read about peekaboo is it's in that early stage of an infant's developing a sense of existing as a self separate from the mother. And so it's almost a literalization of now you see me, now you don't. I did that the wrong way around. But anyway, so the baby is actually getting to enjoy the sense of, oh, I exist. And then, okay, and then it wouldn't have an experience of, oh, I don't exist, because that's oxymoronic. But it has an experience of coming into existence. Here I am. And then kind of disappears again into the mother's psyche, and then pop out it comes. And that's a period of transition that's like birth, psychological birth. And if it's fraught, if it's not smooth, let's say, as in the mother's presence is either too sporadic, aperiodical, and or it's threatening, it's not comforting, it's not loving, it's conditional loving at best, then that process of I exist kind of gets mixed up with, do I exist, right? I'm not even sure, because I feel like I exist, but now there's nobody here, kind of thing. And so then there's the experience not just of a seamless back and forth of to be or not to be, but this annihilation and anxiety. I'm starting to exist, but oh no, it's all coming apart. Right? So that self-awareness becomes self-consciousness, to bring back to your point. There's a terror, there's a shame.
But it's strange, isn't it? That term annihilation anxiety is clearly different to like death anxiety. It'd be very difficult to really explain. Death anxiety, I guess, is really anxiety about the great unknown that is, even though people might be assured that we're just going to rot into the ground. I've never really met anyone who's completely comforted by that fact. There's still an anxiety around it. But annihilation anxiety is really that anxiety about that disembodied fictional self who has 1,000 likes or whatever. It's an annihilation of that. Like if that wasn't there, like your own personal egregore, then you wouldn't exist. Even though you have a body, which you never use, which is your only real existence.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, so it seems like something that must be annihilated. Like Blake said, what can be destroyed must be destroyed, which doesn't mean destroy your body, because your body's going to die anyway. But in terms of beliefs, ideas, preferences, identifications, what we're talking about here, need for validations, it seems like it's an impediment to life and to the life force. Like it's a blockage. I think this identity that gets formed in a traumatic way as a defense against whatever it is and various adverse conditions is a block. I think it blocks the life force. And I think it's a kind of circular again, because we were talking about this a moment ago about the shame and the embarrassment and trying to get to grips with it. I was thinking of something I listened to on an audio just last night, David Kass, I think he's called Perfect Brilliant Stillness, which is it's a non-dual thing, which I'm very ambivalent about non-duality. But I did like this, because he was saying something about how the presence, which is spirit, God, consciousness, life force, the thing he was saying, you can't really name it, or you put it in a different context. It is embodied in a form, your form, my form, many countless different forms, and it's so effective. Like there's so much life here that the body itself starts to say, "I am," and then that I am or that awareness identifies with the body, and it forgets that it's simply life itself saying I am and I always will be, or it wouldn't be I really, but anyway. And it actually thinks, no, this is me. And so then there's a then there begins to develop an experience of existing separately from life itself. And you can see how that could lead, that would lead, that self-awareness, which is somewhat false, really, because it's a false perception, at least according to this model, would become self-consciousness. So you start to think, oh my God, I'm all alone here. Oh my God, I'm surrounded by other, I don't know who, right? This, once you have that sense of existing discreetly, then you're cut off from what you really are. And also you're surrounded by all these other things that potentially are sources of shame, embarrassment, fear, etc. So I think that's, yeah, which comes first, really? I think it's the cutting off from life that then, and there would be some shame in that as well, because we've, something in us has caused us to wall ourselves up against life.
Armoring.
Yeah, armoring. So it's very circular, because the armoring is a result of shame, but then it also, we feel ashamed because we're hiding and we're not facing life.
Yeah. And that very shame is cultivated by the fiction that we were both sort of armored in our reluctance to allow for a pause. I would say that that's armoring, right? But it's the very social credit that we were talking about before that has bolstered in us this notion that we should just keep talking like normal human being conversations that don't have long pauses. And then that is recursive in the sense that, oh yeah, well, actually this is being silly, but you can even just to acknowledge it doesn't mean it goes away, right? This is one of the big problems, I think, with a lot of things, is you can say, some people who say, well, money's fiction. You say, well, that doesn't really get rid of the reality, right? Us saying, oh, it's completely fine to have these pauses, doesn't get rid of the pragmatic reality that was beneath that at the start, even though there is a sort of ridiculous nature to it. Yeah, something there, something to do with freedom and the body and yeah.
Connection also. I mean, that's where you looked away there. That was a signal to me not to say something, because you're still thinking. I notice when I listen to myself, I say deliberately, but not consciously, automatically, but deliberately, to stop the other person saying something because I'm still thinking. It's a signal. And that, it's not good or bad, but part of what I've observed, I've also noticed how when I'm talking, I'm trying not to do it today, when I'm really thinking and talking, I tend to look up or look down, so I'm not connecting. I mean, I know we're on Zoom anyway, but certainly it becomes obvious that I think when I go into deep ruminations, I like to, when I talk, think, talk, I mix them together, I do want to be a bit guarded. It's hard to think and just be seen completely and be looking, right? So all those things, I would say, they have in common both the desire for connection, but the corresponding fear. Like there's something, like what if we go silent, for example, we're still connected, but that becomes an awkward connection. So maybe we just want to break the connection, but then that's awkward.
It's interesting, one of the things I noted down, actually, because this notion of armoring, I mean, I took that term from Reich, but he would say that the place to begin to break down the armoring is with the eyes and with connection, you know, which both of us are self-diagnosed autistic people, so eye contact isn't the best of our ability.
I actually don't have that, though. I don't have a problem with eye contact, no.
Oh, okay.
I don't like handshaking, I don't like touching.
Okay. Well, I have a big problem. Either way, the point, one thing that I thought, yeah, it was intriguing that in the modern psychological context is that EMDR is now this huge thing. This, you know, eye-focused sort of therapy that people are finding very cathartic. And I wonder if it is that just this notion of genuinely getting into your eyes and getting out of... I wonder how much... the big mother, the technological abstractions that we've been talking about have actually sort of parasitically infected the reality with a low level form of depersonalization, which we're all so used to. You know, this notion like the world is, you know, we're not in the world is out there, and you sort of feel like I have to like really open my eyes or get in them. And when you do that, sometimes you think, oh, I'm actually in the world. But it seems a lot of people are existing in this sense of, like, you know, there's almost a lag, or the world is very derealized. And it's just intriguing that the EMDR has become this big thing, and that just getting the eyes and to have connection, to be vulnerable, to be vulnerable, right? I mean, to go back to that notion of embarrassment, I think that maybe, you know, I was going to ask you where to begin with this sort of re-embodiment, if it could be such a thing. And I think just I would say it's like, be vulnerable to being embarrassed.
I'm afraid so, yeah. It's like a worst case scenario. It's baked into the thing. If you want to solve something, you have to experience the very thing that you're trying to get free of. That's a formula, really. It's got to push through it. Yeah, but unfortunately, life provides endless opportunities for embarrassment. Oh,
absolutely. Embarrassment and disappointment. Fuel for the
yeah.
Life. Is there anything you'd like to add about Big Mother?
I got a thought that I had while we were talking just now, but that's not coming to me. I was also wondering, because in the email you said you had all these notes and stuff, and should you send them? Have we even got anywhere near to any of your notes?
We went through the majority of them. The only one that was left, which I think really answers itself, was to do with AI. And I think what we've really been talking about, this abstraction, already is some sort of strange AI in its sense. The agenda was not really with an agenda, this strange intelligence that we're part of, but it's also its own thing. But I'm sort of optimistic about AI, because I wonder if it will push technology to such a degree that technology no longer needs us, and then we have to sit around and go, okay, now what do we do with ourselves? And we have to be again. It's my
optimism. But then what would technology be doing while we're sitting around?
Oh, just pampering us.
Uh-huh. It wouldn't be repopulating the planet with new life forms.
No, I'm not like a singularity.
Singularity.
I'm not on that.
Well, okay, so then there is more I want to say about Big Mother, because we haven't gotten it. I mean, I got to it. I mentioned it early on about something wanting to come into the body, but just because my thesis of AI, which is also in the Kubrickon, is that, well, first of all, that artificial intelligence is an oxymoron. They're incompatible. Mm. But there is something going on whereby machine, what are we going to call it? An alternative to consciousness, if we said machine, like, you know, because machines can play chess, so they do.
Yeah, I understand what you mean, but it has its limitations, right? I mean, point there.
I'm saying, but you can build this matrix that is somewhat cognitive, that can make decisions, but it's not intelligent because it's not sentient, it's not self-aware, it's not even aware. But that, I believe, and that it's almost inseparable now from the actual technology itself, the wires and the cables and all this stuff, and certainly with the cloud, which is physical, it's just not, you know, tangibly physical. That matrix, to, you know, use a very obvious term for it, but the right term, I'd say, because it's like a womb, I believe it is acting as, and has been for some time, as a receptacle / landing pad for two things. One, the human unconscious, and two, for metaphysical, inorganic, disembodied beings, whether they're human or otherwise, or both. I'd say probably human, you know, remains, plus beings that never became human but want to. Or at least want to access human bodies. That's, obviously that's a huge topic in and of itself, but it's definitely missing from today's sort of overview, I'd say, of the Big Mother thesis. Okay. It's demonology, really. This is in the You know, the subtitle is this technological body of evil. We haven't talked about evil at all. We indirectly we have, but you know, talking about objective reality, I'd say there is an objective reality to evil, even if again we have a subjective view of it. Like if we were to be able to experience it objectively, we might not call it evil. What a paradox. But because we're experiencing it this objective force experienced subjectively is objectively evil. Did that even make sense? It's very confusing. I mean, if you see the results, something like transgender that is actually sterilizing children and encouraging young people to remove their breasts or remove their, you know, really, and take drugs, and all, it's objectively destructive, I'd say malevolent, because it's taking advantage of people's weakness for profit. So I'd say that's objectively evil, and that it's sourced in some force that is not human, that actually wants to mess with our bodies.
I'm not sure what to add, because it's a whole other tangent that goes away from our...
I know. You know, I didn't mean to sort of throw it in there at the last minute, but I didn't realize we were so close to the last minute. But it's back. At least I can make it a bit of a coming back to the beginning, because at the beginning you asked and I talked about whether it was my last book, and I say, well, I'm done mapping hell, and I really feel like I am done mapping hell. I feel like, God, if people can't see, you know, what this map shows, if they read these books, then there's not much point in adding more, you know, diagrams in there. But what I realized, well, with Big Mother, I said, okay, I've mapped hell now. Now it's time to actually look at who runs hell. Let's talk about Satan. Now what I've realized, because I'm writing about, dare I even say it, but World War II, so that involves National Socialism and organized Zionism and things like that, you know, huge historical forces that are not understood to this day. Now I'm saying, realizing, oh no, I can't leave hell yet. I've got to go for a meeting with the head honcho. I've actually got to go and meet the guy who built hell and say, all right, time to close down the shop. Now, obviously I'm talking, you know, playfully, poetically, but I think, like, as hard as it is to talk about this topic, I do think somebody has to do it who isn't, you know, a Christian or isn't slightly ideologically entangled with it, if you know what I mean, just to try and talk about it more impartially and less from a basis of belief or ideological indoctrination. Can we identify the source of what's happening here and not just say, well, it's human unconscious and bad shit happens when you're not conscious, even though that's also true?
Well, I'll be sure to put the links for your Substack and Big Mother in the description below. But I feel like that's a good place to finish up.
On the last point, it's technical, but also you can't link to my Landmade Man site because it's been gutted. Like, all the contents have been deleted. And I don't know how it happened. But anyway, we won't speculate yet. So I can't give out Landmade Man, but all the actions at Substack currently, and as far as information about my books, I'll send you the links for the old site, the Horticulture site.
Okay. Yeah, so all sounds great. Jason Horsley, thanks again for...
Well, thank you, James, at Hermetic and your 15,000 followers.